This is East End Inc. Poet, educator, and farmer Scott Chaskey read from his work this month, presented by the Southampton History Museum. Chaskey is a pioneer in the community-supported agriculture movement. He's past president of the Northeast Organic Farming Association of New York and the author of books on agriculture as well as poetry. Now, Scott Chaskey.
But I'm going to start with reading from Seed Time, which has a subtitle on the history, husbandry, politics, and promise of seeds. And I'm going to read from the afterword at the very end of the book, because I thought this was the way to link into the new book that I'm writing now. And it starts with the chapter. The afterword starts with a poem that is set in Cornwall, which is the province on the southwest tip of England, where my wife Megan and I lived for 8 years in the decade of the 80s. And I've written about Cornwall a number of times, in Seed Time and in my previous book. So here's a little poem to start things off. First light rides rocking water, stone blooms brush by windrush on sky and the crackers. Herbs and bone illumine dark earth where blue stars sleep under the candles of Alcamilla. I learned to turn the earth and to cultivate crops in the dark, fertile soil of the cliff meadows perched just above Merlin's Rock, where the interconnection between mineral, flowering plants, and man, far from an abstraction, could be immediately felt. Though these meadows had largely been abandoned by market gardeners, their careful stewardship, carried on for generations, was evident in the artful stone walls used for terracing, the hedges of privet and fuchsia planted to block the strong winds, and the thousands of daffodils and narcissi that blossomed along the pathways each spring. So that gives you an idea of the landscape. Now I'm going to move forward in the afterword. Seeds, like words, behave like capricious and autonomous beings. So if we give them space to perform, perhaps we stand a chance to inherit their intelligence. This seems like a wiser choice to me, rather than to force our intelligence upon them. I began this book with an observation made by Cary Fowler more than 20 years ago. We are in the midst of a mass extinction event in agriculture. And the trend that promotes monocultures and economic consolidation has only intensified in the ensuing years. In 1985, in his book, Altered Harvest, Jack Doyle wrote this: "The genetic centralization of food production is something to worry about. The stuff of national sustenance is involved. The sustaining essential ingredients of life, the most basic components of food making. These are the food determinants at the innermost sanctum of biology. Indeed, these are the ingredients of power. These genes that command the faculty of chloroplasts to bottle the sun so we can have food. They are, in their workings, the closest of a kind to anything we dare call sacrosanct. We owe them more respect than to patent their trade. The health of our fields, the health of our plant communities, and the future of our food supply will depend on whether, as a global culture, we can learn to respect the whole of the biological community and to accept our role as citizens of it and to honor those who still retain the connection. I like the example of clover. I went out today to inspect the autumn crops, those we will harvest into December: cauliflower, broccoli, kale, and collards, and those we will harvest for the winter share to be stored in the root cellar: turnips, radish, rutabaga, and carrots. In the adjacent field where we harvested wheat in July, the flowers of red clover dominate the green blanket that covers the silt loam. After the wheat harvest, I mowed the chaff that remained, and the clover, sown 2 years ago and at home in the shadow of the wheat, was stimulated by this increased access to the light. It is a beautiful plant. three heart-shaped leaves delicately streaked with a whitish V, and at the end of an 18-inch stem, hundreds of purple-red flower whorls holding the space for a seed. It is the tiniest seed we plant, hardly visible in the center of your palm, yet it is responsible for the most significant contribution to field fertility. Having germinated in the shade of the wheat, the delicate white flowers of campion, otherwise uncommon in our landscape, complete the natural bouquet of the field. Our culture, our habitation in this time on earth, is in need of transformation, some say in the shape of a new story. Transformation comes from within, and seeds have mastered the art. Clover does not think about responsibility. Its response to altered circumstances is to give nourishment. I have sown the seeds of clover and seen it come to flower in the fields, and I have tasted the harvest of nutritious food the following season. May we continue to cultivate our fields with the imperishable mystery in mind and to playfully, carefully follow these seeds and nurture them where they desire to go. Called Soil and Spirit. I want to say something about how this actually occurred. This talk came about, which was that a connection with Josh Halsey and Tom, the director of the museum. I think it first came about through an email, and it happens to be about Apios americana, the groundnut. Sagaponic is named after the nut that grows in the ground. That's the Apios americana. And we discovered this in our fields. It grows naturally and has grown here for who knows how many thousands of years. But of course, because of disturbance of development and large scale agriculture, the groundnut has disappeared in many places. Tom and Josh came out to the little garden that I'm now tending in back of one of the fields, and at Quail Hill. They still let me putter around there, even though I graduated from the farm after 30 years, just 2 years ago. Anyhow, I'm going to read about that garden. So the book itself is actually made up of stories from my travels, and you won't get the sense of that from the section I'm reading to you, because this is really about a garden here in Amagansett. But one of the chapters in the book is about a trip to China that I took some years ago to attend a international conference of community-supported agriculture, which was an extraordinary event. I never guessed that I would spend some time in China, but there we were with people from 28 different countries who were practicing a different model, but something very similar to one another. Community-supported agriculture, something I've been involved with for, three decades. So another chapter takes us to New Mexico, where we take part in a wonderful ceremony of harvesting amaranth seeds, led by some amazing people from Guatemala. Another chapter takes us back to Cornwall, where we lived for many years, and out onto this incredible peninsula, another peninsula, but a very different one, and an ancient one. And another chapter is about a teacher that I had. I never imagined I would be able to actually write a chapter about him. Basil Bunting, a Northumbrian poet who just happened to be teaching at the University of Binghamton, Harper College, where I was, in the 70s. And Bunting has been a thread through my life for 50 years.
This is East End Inc. We're listening to farmer and author Scott Chaskey as recorded by the Southampton History Museum in January of 2022.
I'm going to read to you from a chapter called The Remembered Earth. It begins with an epigraph from N. Scott Mamaday, a wonderful indigenous writer. Once in his life, a man ought to concentrate his mind upon the remembered earth, I believe. He ought to give himself up to a particular landscape in his experience, to look at it from as many angles as he can, to wonder about it and to dwell upon it. He ought to imagine that he touches it with his hands at every season and listens to the sounds that are made upon it. He ought to imagine the creatures there and all the faintest motions of the wind. He ought to recollect the glare of noon and all the colors of the dawn and dusk. Dusk, the swallow's hour, and a bright moon rises in the east over the North Atlantic. The ocean is near, I hear it. Just there beyond the railroad tracks in Amagansett Village, a short glide for an osprey, though I cannot see it from my sheltered garden tucked into the back of a Long Island farm field. I am surrounded on every side by robust maples, white pines, an elegant larch, a thick tangle of bittersweet, honeysuckle, and the rampant porcelain berry as I kneel on the sweet-smelling earth, planting beans as the light fades. The varieties of Phaseolus vulgaris are rare, collected by seed travelers from distant places, and I am a willing and joyful conservator. New Mexico, Tuscarora bread, Raffiofi, purple stardust, Flor de Juno Silvio. As the first star appears below the moon, fireflies rise among the grasses, flickering like earthly stars, on familiar terms with this soil. Swallows dip off toward night, and I press the last of the varietals one by one neatly into the row. This silt loam remembers the moment, as do I, as the last of the seed, nightfall, fills the furrow. Flash, a firefly, as the living seed too remembers the silt. So the actual seed I was planting was indeed named Nightfall, at Nightfall. When Ernst and Katrina approached me, they were desperate. Flower growers on rented land, they had just been given 2 weeks to vacate their garden, perennials primarily, planted in a sagaponic field. They heard word of our community farm. Did we have space, a fallow field perhaps, a place to park the plants, if only for a growing season? I sensed they were good growers. Their first concern was for the plants. Salt of the earth, I thought, an intuition that proved to be accurate. We've nurtured these plants from seed to flower. We can't abandon them now, Ernst said. At the time, we were bringing new fields into production season by season as our farm membership expanded, though we had yet to cultivate a fallow field to the south that borders the railroad tracks. You're in luck, I replied. There is an acre waiting for you in the back field within listening distance to the ocean. The lease of 1 acre expanded to 2 within a year, and our relationship, reciprocal from the start, matured with the plants. I supplied tractor work and compost. They offered labor in exchange and a more delicate horticultural understanding and practice. We learned from one another, and the example of a garden surrounded, embraced by a farm, created a firmer, fuller experience. Our annual crop fields expanded to border the garden to the north and south. Like the soil we tended and the plants we cultivated, our human connection was symbiotic, and our shared attention to the specific silt loam continued to ripen. As a protection from the cold north wind and the storm gusts and salt spray from the southwest, and for a gardener's privacy, Ernst and Katrina transplanted the maples and pines that now sheltered the garden I tend. They spaded in a sapling in the southeast corner that today, 40 feet in height, extends sweeping boughs to dance in the daily winds and serves as a perch for mourning doves, red-winged blackbirds, cardinals, and the sharp-shinned hawk. This larch, Larix laricina, stands alone, the only one of its kind within a wide radius. Not common to this turtle island, larch is dominant in the boreal forests of Canada and Siberia. It knows how to endure, as some trees in the forests of British Columbia have done for close to 2,000 years. Larch is also known as tamarack, a well-chosen Algonquian word for a Nordic species. It means wood used for snowshoes. Larix has inspired legends elsewhere in the world. In a Siberian creation story, God first chose to make two trees, a fir and a larch, female and male. In larch forest of the Alps, kindly spirit beings, the Salingen, known as the Blessed Ones, sing among the old growth larch. Here, so near to the Atlantic, it is the spirit from the sea that whispers through the long boughs. A lovely Greek word for whisper translates into English as cythorism, the sound of wind in the trees, cythorism, and I hear it through the larch. One day, Ernst summoned me to witness the results of a month-long project. He gestured at 4 50-gallon garbage bins overflowing with odd-shaped earthy tubers. Now every farmer or gardener has a thick journal and memory full of stories that relate to undesired plant life. Plants that somehow thrive and persist in a crop field or a garden of perennials. Shall I speak again of my acquaintance with various invaders? Nutsedge, dock, galanzoga, purslane, delicious on a plate. Jimson weed, bindweed, mile a minute, mumweed. My OED, Oxford English Dictionary, lists a weed as a wild herb springing where it is not wanted. The sing-song effect of that phrasing would not satisfy many serious growers, nor did the long vines capable of growing 20 feet in a year, twirling out from those tubers, impress our flower growers. Had I known at the time the history indigenous to this ground of Apios americana, our discussion would have been prolonged. Ernst and Katrina were ace gardeners, careful and attentive to a seasonal market. They made their living selling flowers, and a weed that thrived on the support of healthy cultivars must be rooted out. They were thorough beyond imagining. Out of an acre of prime soil, 200 gallons of groundnuts. Sagaponack, a village just to the west of Amagansett, derives its name from Apios americana, nut that grows in the ground, once a staple food for indigenous peoples. It is known by other names as well: wild bean, Indian potato, potato bean, hodoyamo, cinnamon vine, and groundnut, though the sweet melodic Lenape word hopness captures the wild spirit of Apios, which is Greek for pear. The Wampanoags taught early settlers how to harvest and cook groundnuts, and Thoreau wrote about his own foraging. He said, "In case of a famine, I should soon resort to these roots." They are leguminous, in the family of peas, with attractive maroon and white flowers, pea-like in appearance, though hardier, with an acrid smell, in my humble opinion. In botanical terms, the tubers are not roots, but rhizomatous stems. Like other legumes, the threads of the rhizome interact with bacteria that inhabit the soil. Bacteria is adept at capturing nitrogen. The Apios root stems provide a surface for nodules to fix, and the overall soil health is improved. Nearby trees gladly accept nitrogen in exchange for carbohydrates. They exude in a process handsomely titled mutualism, a brand of symbiosis. Groundnuts reproduce along the thin rhizome like beads on a necklace. Native to many soils and naturally abundant, like other tubers, they sweeten as the ground turns colder. Though quite high in protein content, 17%, triple that of potatoes, and rich in isoflavone genistein, is my best pronunciation, an anti-carcinogenic compound, Apios long ago fell out of favor. Attempts to introduce the tuber to Germany, France, and Ireland during the potato famine over a century ago did not succeed. In the 1980s, a professor at Louisiana State University devised trials hoping to domesticate the groundnut to increase tuber size and yield. He claimed that domestication of the golden nugget would be a benefit to mankind. After a decade of improvements and promising crops, funding slipped away, the Apios Tribune ceased to be published, and a dedicated professor moved on. Perhaps there is something in this humble tuber that rejects popular approval and a place in the produce section of supermarkets. Enrique Samón relates a story of the indigenous Creek Nation. An unknown band of people arrived in Creek territory, and the two groups lived in peace. Eventually, members intermarried, and some confusion followed. How to include those children born into existing Creek clans? The solution required naming a new clan to assure kinship among the people. The chosen name, White Potato Clan, groundnut. After Ernst and Regina departed for a farm of their own, this garden passed through several transformation and changes of name. Regina, a German by birth, was fond of garden gnomes, and a population had moved in to commune with iris and dianthus, dahlia and narcissus. The name of the garden reflected the cultivator's taste, the Gnomer's Garden. Grant, with his beehives, followed the flower growers, and Appius mellifera provided a title, the Bee Garden. Mary of Bee's Knees, queen of beekeepers, settled into the bee garden and her hives thrived. When Mary shifted her bees to a nearby field, we expanded our Chinese medicinal plantings into the herb garden. Now the groundnut had a place to revive with bees as near neighbors. Our flower growers were indeed weeders without compare, though Appios, native to the soil, found a way to survive. Could we ask more of a traditional food source? Another story that has to do with a bean. And at this point, it's a Shinnecock bean. And so that's going to finish this chapter. But I want to acknowledge this is the ancestral land of the Shinnecocks and the Montaukett and the other tribes, who 17 total, who lived on this land for thousands of years. It is autumn, and I am harvesting the seeds of Anna Morena, a plant I am strangely drawn to, despite its far from showy, somewhat odd appearance, and of Scrofularia, or figwort, a compact bush that produces tiny red-brown flowers that rival Angelica in attracting pollinators, especially bumblebees, five times the size of the flower. For the bee to gather nectar requires dedication and dexterity of wings and abdomen. 32 years ago, seated on a 1952 Massey Harris tractor, I seeded a cover crop of rye across this 20-acre farm field to bring it into production. Today, in the herb garden that nests between fields of squash and potatoes, I am harvesting a diversity of seeds, seeds that have served a diversity of cultures. The means of transport and tillage is simplified, the soil is improved after decades of regenerative farming practice based on traditional indigenous methods. The messages I receive from maple, larch, Queen Anne's lace, blackberry lily, balloon flowers, still blooming, silt loam, and the southwest wind are more nuanced, layered lightly. I've improved too as a listener. Among the rare beans I harvest now that the dried pods crackle is the cranberry-colored Shinnecock bean, a variety above all others that belongs here. Several years ago at an organic farming conference in Syracuse, New York, on the land of the Haudenosaunee, I visited the display table of a champion seed saver, Lisa Bludnick, known for her generosity and for maintaining a collection of 1,000 bean varieties. "I like the look of this one," I said. "What is the history?" "Lisa, that is the Shinnecock bean, and I was given it by a seed saver from Kentucky." Surprised, engaged, I continued, "I'm a neighbor of the Shinnecock Nation. My children attended school with Shinnecock children, and I gardened with the keeper of their seeds. Will you trust me with them?" "They are yours," she said. I returned to Long Island with a small packet and called Shane at his home on the reservation. This is Shane Weeks. his immediate question, are they cranberry colored? Yes. I've heard about those beans and I have been searching for years, Shane replied, spirited. The Shinnecock beans have been on a journey. Lisa was given them by a well-known third generation seed saver, a Cherokee ethnobotanist from Wildwood Farm in Artemis, Kentucky, Chris Hubbard. The story is, Chris's grandfather was given beans by a fisherman from Long Island, and their name reports the provenance. Grown out for years at Wildwood Farm and by Lisa at Bludnick Farm in the Susquehanna River Valley, and by yours truly, the cranberry beans, after an exodus of 100 years, have now returned to their home ground. The variety and coloration reflects the years of travel, the various gardens. The round beans vary from deep cranberry to light rose to white, artfully streaked with red, whether grown in Shinnecock soil or in Amagansett silt loam. When I shuck them, the story shimmers out. Rare varieties of beans, a cranberry bean that journeyed forth a century ago from the Shinnecock Reservation and is now rematriated, an indigenous groundnut that twines where it will, Asian plants transplanted to North Atlantic island soil, a folly, some would say, and I might agree. In fact, I will soon introduce you to another folly in another chapter, and a near neighbor with a mission that rhymes with my soil journey. I recall a passage from the writer Donald Culross Peaty. The fabric is whole and strong, the web is intricate to unravel. We are ourselves part of it. These vital partnerships, these symbioses, are crossed threads in the web that go back to plant life's beginnings. So this is the close of the chapter. And remember that I began at dusk. Dawn, almost. Though a waning crescent moon rises in the east, just preceding the sun, over the tangled hedge, over the tallest reach of the larch. The sky, an ocean of light like a tide returning. To the south, a thin river of mist caps the newly seeded field of rye. Here in the garden, within the net of moon, ocean, earth, every living thing reflects like a jewel. The auburn tips of timothy grass, the three-pointed leaves of liquid amber, the red clusters of Sichuan pepper, the vines of apios intertwined on young conifers. All that is flooded with dew flickers in the early light. There is something in the flight of the sparrowhawk, in her quick fall from the hedgerow to alight on silt loam, something familiar, remembered, just so as daylight fills the furrows.
This is East End Inc. We heard farmer, poet, and author Scott Chaskey as presented this month by the Southampton History Museum. His books include Seed Time, on the history, husbandry, politics, and promise of seeds, from Rodale Press in 2014, and This Common Ground, Seasons on an Organic Farm, from Penguin in 2006. On February 10th at 11 a.m., the Southampton History Museum will present Joan Baum talking about The Klansman, a novel that reignited the KKK, a book published in 1905. Canio's Cultural Cafe, along with Sag Harbor's John Germain Library and the Eastville Historical Society, will present an Afro-American writer read-in on February 10th at 6:30 p.m. You can sign up to read. Instructions are at the calendar of events at canios.wordpress.com. East End Inc. is heard on the 4th and occasional 5th Wednesday at this same time. Programs are archived at moreeastendinc.blogspot.com. Tonight's East End Inc. was produced by Tony Ernst with the aid of Connor Flanagan of the Southampton History Museum.